name is Will Kennedy, and I want to start off by telling you a little bit about my background so you'll know how to hear me. I'm a Southern Presbyterian. As of a month, there's no such thing. I'm a Presbyterian. Yes. Our two churches have reunited after 122 years, and very exciting kind of event for people of my generation. I'm a minister in that church. And I was a school teacher, a history teacher, in high school and then in a junior college, and I decided to go to seminary, and I went to seminary in Virginia. And I was a Methodist in the college I taught in before that, and directed the Glee Club, and so I directed the choir and became a Methodist for a couple of years. And then I had to become a Presbyterian again to go to seminary to be a Presbyterian preacher. Rather narrow-minded of the Presbyterians, I thought, to force me back. And then I went to Yale for my doctoral work and was a Congregationalist in what became the United Church of Christ. I served in a church there while I was in my graduate program, and then went back to Richmond to teach in the seminary, teach Christian education. And after 8 years there, I was restless with the academic setting for my total ministry, so I went to our Board of Education, like yours, like the LCA one in Philadelphia, and so forth, and worked there 4.5 years, and then I went to Geneva, to the World Council of Churches, to be one of three people in the staff of the new Office of Education that was established after the Assembly at Uppsala. And we stayed there through the assembly at Nairobi in 1975 and then came back to the States, where I went to Atlanta to an experimental ministry in international education. One of the difficulties of people who go to the World Council to work is that there's not an easy re-entry back into ministry in the U.S. Local churches figure, you know, that's not the kind of preparation for teaching and visiting us in the hospital and preaching every Sunday that we want. You're kind of oddball, and so people are sort of suspicious. That's one reason I hold on to my Southern accent and try to maintain its purity. When I come back into our church, most of the groups I met with knew very little about the World Council, and what they did know they didn't like because of the way it was reported usually. So I discovered if I had a strange accent, then that was an additional obstacle to interpreting. I was not that kind of person over there anymore. I'd become foreign or alienated or whatever. So that was a good stretch back in Atlanta, where we were with people we knew, with people in our own church. We worked interdenominationally trying to help local churches work on education for the new kind of mission that was going on in the world. A lot of changes, really, when you think about it. Those of us that are my age, when we grew up, mission was relatively simple. It was from center outward. We had the gospel. We took it to the other people and all. And now, within our lifetime, most of those nations have become independent, and most of those churches are now vigorous churches. And there's still a good bit of dependency, but it's a two-way traffic. And the nature of mission has changed, and it's changed in ways that threaten people back in Germany and the U.S. and Scandinavia who have been the ones who were sending it out. So we worked experimentally for 4 years trying to figure out how to help churches do that, how to work with different forms of what we call international education. It could have been called mission education, but we didn't want it to sound too churchy. We wanted to work on the broader picture. And then in 79, I moved to New York, where I teach religion and education at Union Seminary, and worked with the doctoral program at Teachers College and with the Jewish Theological Seminary across the street. So I'm just back from London now, where we had our sabbatic leave, and I've been working over there on the questions of ideology and theological education, and that we can talk about if you'd like. But anyway, we had 6.5 years in Geneva on the staff of the World Council of Churches. Our children went through adolescence there. We we were molded by being aliens in a foreign land into a much more intimate family than we would have been if we'd stayed in the States, where before we left our kids were scattering into their gangs and so forth. But over there we were among the token Americans. The token Americans on a staff. There were 10 or 12 of us out of the executive staff of 100, 110 or 20. And we came from such diverse backgrounds that we did not easily get into much social activity together. So it was a relatively lonely kind of experience. And from 1969 to 1975 were not the easiest years to represent the United States of America. Mm-hmm. People from other parts of the world always asking us, how can your government be doing what it's doing in bombing Cambodia or the Watergate business? People have a hard time understanding what it's like to live in our country and why the churches seem to be so impotent in stopping what looked to many people around the world, many Christians around the world, like very unchristian things for a so-called Christian nation to be doing. So that was a tough time of learning, very, very valuable to experience that in the midst of a community of fellow Christians with different accents and different languages and so forth. And to speak my mother tongue in a way that most of the British English folks, and that was the predominant style of the English language used there, those who came from England and so forth, but also most of the rest of the world, learned English through British style schools and stuff. So to have your own language, not the predominant style, was another kind of pressure on us. Anyway, that was a very rich kind of experience. And so when we were coming here for this meeting, I wrote Larry and told him that often I found that people had relatively little opportunity in the flesh to talk to somebody who had worked in the World Council and who knew it from within. So these 7 years since we left, 8 years, I have not kept up with all the details of what's going on in the World Council, but I do subscribe to the basic literature and try to keep up. And so what I bring you is not so much detailed reporting on what's going on right now, but a chance for you to ask questions about it, take advantage of my experience, and for me to share with you something of what I think it's all about. So I think that we have another session on Saturday. I very much want to move to your concerns and questions, but I think it might be good for me to give 10 or 15 minutes sort of overview of the how it came to be and what it's all about. And then in that context, the questions can be fitted in, and then I won't have to keep trying to paint a framework in response to specific questions. The origin, the official history, traces the origin back to the Faith and Order movement, which had a big meeting in 1910. That was mostly a meeting of theologians and church leaders who by 1910 realized that after 400 and more years of the Protestant Reformation and the migration patterns which had scattered folks all around the world, the church was visibly so lacking in unity that it hampered the missionary outreach, it hampered the self-understanding of the church to have in almost every place in the world a whole lot of different official Christian bodies. And so there was an increasing desire to ask the question of unity. What does it mean to be one body? To have one baptism? To worship one Lord when you've got all these different versions and accents and so forth. So the Faith and Order movement was the one that tried to achieve unity through agreement on matters of faith and doctrine, to ask whether the doctrine that brought us together, the belief systems, really forced the kind of separations that we had. And was it possible theologically to develop a study program and conversations that would help us somehow reestablish among ourselves a sense of oneness at a deeper level and present to the world a oneness that we claimed from our basic founding in Jesus Christ, but didn't seem to manifest too well around the world. It was an ecclesiastical unity, and many of those people had visions of bringing the churches all back together into one church. The second major strain was what was called Christian Life and Work, which had a huge first meeting in 1919. It was for developing a Christian unity for common witness and action in political and economic life. In other words, as you dealt with the kinds of things that happened in the First World War, when close Christian colleagues across the border between France and Germany were killing each other, and when you had the kinds of economic recessions, the cycles of economics that through the latter part of the 19th century and the early part of the 20th century, the kind of civilization that came out of the 19th century had jagged edges all over the place. And most of the countries are struggling to figure, how do you build up a society that can take it, that can handle the economic and political changes that are going on. Now, in that, the churches all, to one degree or another, participate with their members and... That will be a blatant interruption in that tape. The churches realized more and more acutely what it meant to be disunited. Because if you had a government policy or a desire for disarmament in the 20s or whatever it might be, if you had anything like that within a nation, much less internationally, and here came the Lutheran churches, and here came the Presbyterian churches, and here came the Anglican churches, and here came the Catholic churches, then the people who were making the decisions heard a disunited voice. And so there was a desire to have some united voice in the conversations about what kind of society is most humane, most human. And the churches, with ambivalence, because there was no inherited pattern that made it easy to know how to be politically involved. But nevertheless, they could not stand back and watch a society develop in ways that obviously looked contradictory to Christian faith and the vision of what human life could be like in Jesus Christ. So in that, there was a desire, another kind of desire for unity, to work together. And on the mission field, this was apparent too, as the mission agencies began to divide up the countries in Africa, for instance, so that the Lutherans and the Presbyterians wouldn't be fighting each other in each little village. So they'd say, you take that one, we'll take that one, and so forth. And so there was cooperation that just had to develop. And the Life and Work movement was one of those that dealt with the social and political issues which were threatening human welfare and dignity. Now, there were some others too. The World Sunday School Association had started an international thing back in the 1870s. They used to have international conventions. The World YMCA and YWCA had begun to put together their networks internationally from the founding in the 19th century. World Student Christian Federation had the same kind of thing. So, at various points in the thinking of the church and the work of the church, there was obvious moving toward structures of cooperation. Now, that all began to head toward some overall agency that could unite those concerns. It actually happened in 1948 when the World Council of Churches was founded. It was ready in the late 30s, but then the war broke in Europe and most of the leaders of the churches were deeply pained by the involvement in that war, which not only, like the First World War, sort of shattered the liberal optimistic hopes that came out of our Western civilizations out of the 19th century, but the pain of the Holocaust and that sort of thing was really a traumatic experience for them. And so it was out of that decade or two that the World Council finally formed itself in 1948 in Amsterdam. And when I went to Geneva, I got to know people who'd been caught in the middle of that. For instance, a lady named Madeleine Barrault, who is what the French call in femme formidable. She's a great old lady. And she was one of the young people in a conference that brought together young people from all over the world, mostly Europeans and North Americans, in 1939. And she was one who would tell stories of bumping into fellow delegates to that youth, that Christian youth meeting, in concentration camps, in prisoner of war camps, in bomb shelters. Experiences that we have not had to have in our country. And she was involved, for instance, in going into the camps, the internment camps in France, Vichy France, as a church worker. And often she would go in to hold services, and because it was a relatively loose kind of arrangement, sometimes she'd stay a whole week till the next week and just be underground in the camp in order to counsel people and minister to people and get to know them and do the kind of church supportive services that you can't just do going in for a worship service once a week. And so she would run into people who'd been at that meeting, at that Amsterdam Youth Assembly in 1939. Some of them were prisoners, some of them were guards. And it was that crazy kind of mixture. So the many of these pioneers of the ecumenical movement, like Bissatou, who wrote this book on it, and then we pass this around to some pictures of those old meetings here, but Bissatouft was the first head of it, and he was in Geneva the whole time, and one of the things they did there was to help what we would call in our history an underground railroad. A great many refugees, Jews and others, were able to get from Switzerland, across the border into Switzerland, and then across into Vichy France, and out through Spain to the Western world where they were safe. So there was that kind of experience of Christian unity as a serious but still unstructured reality of life and struggle. World Council of Churches in its early formation was largely that European North American reality. What's happened in the last decade or two, and while we were there, it was in the process of happening, is as all these churches started, there were some hundred or so member churches at the first time, they're now something like 303. Although with the Presbyterian reunion, it'll be dropped back one. But there are new member churches coming in all the time. Most of them have come from what were former mission lands, Africa, Asia, Latin America, and so forth. So that the World Council now represents most of the Christian world, with the exception of the Roman Catholic Church and the Southern Baptists and a few other major churches. The U.S. has the most member churches. I think there are 31, and it really includes most of the major church bodies in the U.S., with the exception of the Southern Baptists and the Catholics. In 1961, the International Missionary Council joined it in the Delhi Assembly in India. That was the cooperative agency of all the Protestant mission efforts around the world that had divided up the countries and so forth. At that meeting also, the Orthodox churches of the world joined, the Russian Orthodox, Greek Orthodox, Eastern Orthodox in India, and so forth. And that brought a huge proportion of Christians in the world into the World Council. They have always felt that they moved into a Western organization. And some of these materials, for instance, this one, the Orthodox experience has generally been through the centuries, 20 centuries of Christian history, has been one under persecution. They have not usually been power churches in Turkey, and they've lived in Muslim lands. So they often have a quite different kind of style of Christian experience than Protestants in the West, who are much more rational. The liturgy is much richer for them, much more continuous. Even in Greece and Russia, where you have had official churches under the czars, and still in Greece, you have a pattern of piety that is quite different. And so the Orthodox have been in the World Council now for 22 years, still very restless, because they still feel that it's not really an Orthodox Christian experience. It still is Western. Most of the sub-staff are Western Europeans. Most of the support staff are Swiss, because the Swiss won't give work permits much. We wanted secretaries from all over the world as the executive staff were, but as long as there were Swiss secretaries unemployed, the Swiss said, hire our people, which we do too. And so it's a continual impression that it's mostly a Western game. Now, from some of the critics in Germany or England or the US, it's not enough a Western game. In other words, those changes have brought the diversity of the Christian world into it in ways that mean that by the time 5 or 10 years are over, it is such a widely representative group that it has done something that churches in every land misunderstand and may not like, may not agree with. The churches that think of themselves as the powerful ones that contribute most of the budget, like the German and the U.S. churches, of course, are most troubled by that. The churches that are in minority situations have never been used to dominating decisions, and so they accept the kind of negotiation that goes on and with less strain. But the chief pressure that the World Council, because of its wide world representative nature, brings comes on those churches that are used to running things. And those are the churches with a lot of money, German churches and American churches chiefly, Canadian churches, Scandinavian churches, British churches, and so forth. So that the dynamic is that continually sort of struggle. And it is an intense struggle within to find a way to make the oneness of our faith in Jesus Christ operative in the kinds of activities that, as best the member churches through their representative participation can say, oh, these are the priorities that a relatively weak little organization bringing us all together ought to be doing for us. What are the things we do need to be bothered about because we live in this country, or we live in this race, or we live in this tradition of Christianity? And so it's a continual struggle to find ways to move, even when you identify the areas you need to move in, like mission or faith and order or education or aid around the world. Now, I could go on and talk about that, but let me simply remind you that the basis of membership in the World Council, and this is a quote, it's a fellowship of churches which confess the Lord Jesus Christ as God and Savior according to the Scriptures, and therefore seek to fulfill their common calling to the glory of one God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. Now, that's about as substantial a Trinitarian base as any member church could draw up, and most of our Lutheran and Presbyterian churches have drawn them up in long statements of confession since the time of Luther and Calvin. But this is a kind of summary, and again, it shows generally the Western Reformed and Lutheran Protestant tradition. That's not an uncomfortable statement for any of us in this room if we've been nurtured in Lutheran and Presbyterian doctrine. You affirm the divinity of Jesus Christ in terms that some of our churches don't use. We will affirm the divinity, but we will not call Jesus Christ God in that kind of sequence that smoothly. Mostly we get at that through the traditional liturgies, which don't do it this way. But that's what the World Council of Churches is. Now, Let me try to give a little overview of the spread of programs, and then we'll see. And these materials indicate it. The Nairobi Assembly in 1975 in Africa tried to look at all the morass of things that were going on and point out four major priorities for the last 8 years of the work. One of them was the expression and communication of our faith in the triune God. And that dealt chiefly with things like the World Mission and Evangelism part of the World Council of Churches, which has its contacts with all the old mission agencies of all the churches and does various kinds of things. It had a big meeting in Melbourne, Australia in 1980 under the theme, Your Kingdom Come. And it's the agency in the World Council that successively has had huge meetings of mission-oriented church people around the world, the leaders of the mission programs, to try to think together about what is the nature of mission as the world changes. And increasingly, those meetings have had more and more third world people, people from former mission churches. So they are raising more and more questions about the relationship of the church to the poor. They raised more clearly at that meeting than they had previously whether the mission of the church, the evangelistic mission of the church, more and more belongs to the poor churches of the world. In other words, whether the people who most need mission now are, first of all, of course, those who have never heard the gospel preached, but an American in the hills of Indonesia cannot do that as well as an Indonesian Christian in the hills of Indonesia. So that how do we share the resources that enable that preaching of the gospel to go around, but even more so, how do you then turn to the kinds of questions about the world that the poor raise? Like, why are we starving when there's plenty of food? So that intrudes itself onto the agenda of the mission agencies. Well, the mission agencies are sent up to take things from here over there, not to take their questions from there over here. So your mission agencies in New York and meetings like this have to deal with that traffic, that dialogue, that questioning, that negotiating about who owns the money that lets mission have. If it's really God's church, then why is all the decision about how the resources for mission are spent in the hands of those who happen to have the money to give? If it's stewardship, then how do you make the decisions about the stewardship? And why is it that the people who happen to have the wealth, if it's God's wealth for mission, why is the decision-making still large back in the North Atlantic world as strongly as it is? Why can't we share those resources so that instead of paying $30,000 to support a white missionary couple of the Presbyterian Church in Zaire, we could support a dozen Zairean missionaries? And why is it so hard to change those patterns? Well, part of it goes back to the patterns we've inherited here about how you support missions and so forth. So that kind of question comes up continually, and it comes up with increasing sharpness as these other churches gain some strength and begin to take on more than just dependency. They begin to say, how can we do our mission here? And then even more threatening to us, how do we do our mission to you? You're eating all that food. You're spending all that money to feed grain to cattle instead of letting the world have bread. And how do we pose that mission question to you? What is our mission responsibility to the rich churches, to the sending churches? Well, we don't have any good ways to handle that, because that comes across the grain of the way we've been raised as Christians in a mission situation. That's the kind of question that they discuss. Now, the mission part of the World Council puts out this journal, International Review of Mission, four times a year. And I'll pass this around so you can sort of see if you're seriously interested in that, or if your church has some active mission activity. This is the kind of thing that would be good to have in your library and for you to read and see what the church leaders around the world who are working at the mission type questions are thinking and working on, the study papers, the documents, the articles, and so forth. That part of the World Council also has some work in urban and rural mission, helping particularly those places where you need to concentrate on new methods of rural evangelism in the parts of the world that are rural. Increasingly, urban mission and new industrial areas like the seaport outside of Lagos in Nigeria, where there's been a very creative kind of ministry developing in that brand new urban area with all the problems of sudden urbanization and expansion that we're familiar with in places here. It's also the one where the Orthodox have been lodged, and there's a couple of staff members in the unit in Geneva who are from the Orthodox world. One of them is Ian Bria, who edited the book on the Orthodox with the icon on front, and that has increased the Orthodox perception. The Orthodox were very suspicious of mission, because mission in an Orthodox country was often proselyting. When we would go to the Middle East, for instance, our missionaries were just as eager to convert Orthodox Christians as they were Muslims. And so the involvement of the Orthodox Christian tradition has posed a necessity for dialogue and understanding that didn't quite fit the evangelistic mission patterns. And so they have placed staff people in there, and that book on martyria, witness, mission, they much prefer the term witness to the term mission, because sending to them is all often meant the aggressive rich churches sending missionaries to convert our people to another type of Christianity. At any rate, the expression and communication of our faith in the triune God. And this is the official report of the whole work of the council from Nairobi to Vancouver. And if any of you are interested in it, it's not over in the bookstore, but this is my copy. If you'd like to take it overnight and look through the whole thing, it has a whole chapter describing the more detailed work of that priority in the last 8 years. The second is the search for a just, participatory, and sustainable society, and in good Western form, JPSS, Just, Participatory, and Sustainable Society. Now, how can you live with a title like that for a program, but how can you drop any of it, or what words would you prefer? And this is the group that has looked at the Christian vision of what the world might be, and has said there are key components that we really need to work on. Justice, obviously. Participation. That is, we do not see in the biblical visions that Paul's been talking about, for instance, that it's a matter that's done for people. It's a matter that people do together. And our democratic tradition gives that certain kinds of insight that we believe is closely tied to our Christian understanding of what it means to be human. Not to have other people make decisions that determine how your life is, but for you to be part of the process that does it. And the third, sustainable. That's the ecological question. Now, those have been part of a large program with many parts of the World Council to try to hold those together. And it includes things like a big conference in 1979 at MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, on science and technology and faith. And I don't have them with me, but there are two or three huge volumes of the findings. They gathered together several hundred people, leading scientists from all over the world, most of them Christian, devoted Christians, who in their scientific vocations were worrying about things like human biology, like the production of new forms of human life through all of those experiments, through the questions of nuclear energy. And this conference brought together theologians and scientists and fed back into the churches through those representatives and through these publications a whole lot of tough, complicated thinking about the ethical questions involved in all of that from the Christian perspective. It was followed by a nuclear hearing in Amsterdam last year, and at that hearing they had representatives from different parts of the world, including the Eastern Bloc from Russia, again Christian, Orthodox Russian scientists, as worried as our scientists are about the implications of the nuclear, not just the nuclear arms race, but nuclear energy itself. And so there are various forms of follow-up. There's a kind of monitoring cooperative effort to keep in touch with those Christian biologists who are working on the front edge of the DNA and all of that sort of stuff, to bring Christian concerns together. And here again, it's sort of like the 1919 meeting, to have each church coming at such a massive development that's worldwide isolated from one another doesn't make sense. So the World Council provides the machinery for bringing together those concerns to address those issues. Another part of that is the International Affairs Commission, which was part of the World Council before it actually formed and has been part of it ever since. It works closely with UN agencies and has a staff member in the UN building in New York. If you go there for any of the seminars or for that, I hope you'll go visit the Church Center at the United Nations. The Methodists run the best kind of seminars for people who come from around the country to get involved in it a bit, see what's going on. But the World Council has traditionally had a close tie with certain parts of the UN network. It was, its members were integrally related to the development of the Declaration of Human Rights back in the 40s and 50s, and some of the key people in framing those documents were related to the church's participation in that through the Church's Commission on International Affairs. They have had particular work going on militarism and on human rights. They work very closely with the High Commissioner on refugees and human rights problems. They will send delegations from the member churches to countries that are particularly flagrantly disabusing people. They've had some special studies on torture and what relation the Christian faith about human beings is to that sort of use of human beings, etc., etc. So that international affairs part of the World Council again furnishes a way for the member churches to be involved. We got to know Ole Dahlén, who was the head of that, the president, chairman, convener, moderator, whatever the title is, of the commission of the churches on that. He's an evangelical covenant church member from Sweden and has been a diplomat to the UN from Sweden for many years. A distinguished white-haired looking man who just sort of represents the combination of Christian concern for international affairs with presence, diplomatic presence and style. Anyway, another part of that is what's called Interchurch Aid and Refugee and World Service. It's the huge part of the World Council traffic. More money goes through it than any other part. And it's the coordinating agency for the relief services. If in the Beirut, in the Lebanese situation, it has played a major role. And again, it's inevitable that there be some such organization. Church World Service does that for the American agencies, but if you had a British agency and an American agency and a German agency and a Dutch agency all pouring in to a situation of crisis at the same time, it's more than the local churches can handle. And so the World Council and the Church Aid and Refugee Agency furnishes that channeling. And Lutheran Aid and Church World Service and other agencies are in close touch always with the staff of this in Geneva and with that commission in figuring out the most efficient ways to take Christian charity aid, blankets, food, whatever. And it's a massive operation. And it coordinates as well as channels. It helps it work well around the world. Another one deals primarily with development, with the aid of the poor and development education and so forth. The search for a just, participatory, and sustainable society. The third priority was the unity of the church and its relationship to the unity of humankind. Now that's a new angle on the unity of the church question, asking what does it mean for the unity of humankind. The Faith in Order Commission is part of that, dealing with the question of unity, and the International Review of Missions, the red one here, prints up the document of which they're most proud from this last period, Baptism, Eucharist, and Ministry. The Faith and Order Commission includes Roman Catholics, Southern Baptists as observers, well, as participants, really. And it's probably the major center for thinking about such things that goes on in the world. And that document represents the work of 10 or 15 years of looking at the different ways we baptize, the different ways we serve the Eucharist, the different ways we recognize ministry, ordained ministry. And it has really probed deeply in those to where these theologians, who are the ones most self-interested in such questions, say there's no real fundamental problem. If you understand what the circumstances were for Luther's fight with Rome over transubstantiation and consubstantiation and all, you see that it was a problem in an age when the way you asked that question forced it to be a problem. But now, after all the time we've had since then, that's not basically a problem that should divide us. And what that document has now been done is sent out to all the churches, and you'll be getting ripples of this through your networks of the Lutherans. What that document does is say, let's study those and see if we can just remove those things so that there will be intercommunion, so that any Christian can share with any other Christian in the Eucharist, so that any Christian baptism will be recognized by any other Christian church, so that any minister ordained in any church will be recognized by any other. Now, we are not there yet, obviously, but the World Council is one of the places where that sort of happens. And there are all kinds of pressures from down below. That was a lady who was mayor of a little town in Uganda, Janet Wasonga, who was on our committee over there. And after one of these long debates in the Central Committee in Berlin, that particular meeting, where they'd been reporting on relations with Rome, and how do you deal with this, and how do you deal with that, and why can't we have the Eucharist together? She stood up and she said, well, we are doing fine by the rigidities of the faith and order of the theological establishment. Anyway, that's an interesting one to watch. Another one of that was the study of the community of women and men in the church, which Frances, my wife, is specialist studying now. She was not there, but she's particularly interested in it, and she'll have a session this afternoon on that in the Sheffield Conference. That one just scares the Orthodox world to death, because they have a deep tradition that goes back to what they call ontology, that women and men are so different that there is no way you can think of ordaining a woman. Well, most of us who come from other traditions don't move easily into that sort of thing, but most of our churches have. The Church of England's still having a huge hassle over it. But I think the LCA and ALC have had women ministers for a number of years now. Mm-hmm. And once you get used to it, you wonder why the fuss. Well, if you go to some of those meetings, you understand more why the fuss. It's just different ways of approaching it, but that one is a part of that whole search for unity. Also included in that one, in the report that you're looking at, is the program to combat racism, which is dealing with the question of the unity of humankind. What does it mean to be human together? And that's where the racism question comes sharply to the fore. Now that's the part of the World Council work that gets most of the publicity. It's the part that was established after Uppsala. Martin Luther King was scheduled to be one of the major speakers at the Uppsala Assembly in 1968, and he was killed in, what was it, April, May that year, and the assembly was that summer. So his absence was dramatic evidence of the virulence of human sin expressed in racist form. And racism is not something that's just a U.S. phenomenon, obviously, nor is it simply a black-white problem, but that tends to be the major structural location of the problem. In the Western world, the connection of the political and economic structures to racism is what the World Council group that developed that program from all the churches decided to concentrate on. They decided that they would set up a special fund, realizing that they did not have the authority under the Constitution to spend the World Council's funds, or that most churches could not spend their ministers' pensions funds or things on controversial things. So they set up a special fund to give grants to groups that were combating racism, not just trying to deal with it, but really fighting it. And this, of course, concentrated it in our country, in Mississippi. The fund gave money to groups there who were working for land rights for blacks as the small farms were eaten up and so forth. It concentrated in Africa, naturally. And that's where most of the explosiveness came, when they would grant money to the National Front in Zimbabwe, for instance. And what was happening there, as happened in our revolution, was that you had part of the country under the control of the what we would call patriots in our revolution, what our press calls guerrillas. And the Africans say, how come you call us guerrillas when your patriotic independence war heroes you call patriots? Why can't you think of us like George Washington fighting a colonial power at a distance that's controlling us against our will? Why this change of terminology? Why do you think of us as terrorists when we do the kinds of things we were proud for doing to the British in the Boston Tea Party, et cetera, et cetera? Well, what's involved is 200 years of history where racism has been so much part of our conditioning that we don't really know how to get free of it. So when those questions come up and organizations like the National Front ask for money, for grants, then this committee, bless them, this small representative committee, has to look at all those and decide which one. I was not in on that directly, but I was close enough to some of the people. I used to play bridge once in a while at a meeting as a young staffer who could arrange it with Dr. Blake, Eugene Carson Blake, and one of the other American leaders. And one night at the meeting of the executive committee, we got Richard von Weizsäcker, who is now the mayor of West Berlin, Christian Democratic Union Party official, who played bridge. It was hard to find bridge players in that circle over there, but one night after a meeting we played bridge together. He was involved the next day in the agony of whether to vote for some of those things, knowing that back home in Germany, he was the only German in that group. You can't have 150 people making those kinds of decisions. He knew that some of the people in the churches and some of the Landeskirche, the regional churches, were all for going strong to try to help support the people that were working for independence from Portugal. Others were not. And he knew that whichever way he voted, he was going to get lambasted back home. And that meeting happened to be the first one when he cast a positive vote instead of abstaining. So that the representatives we send are caught. Back home, they often are perceived as radical because they get in that discussion and they see the dimension. They hear privately what the African blacks from South Africa, for instance, cannot say publicly because they'll be put in jail when they go back if they urge divestment of funds or whatever. And so they get a sense of the depth of the passion of the black Christian Africans around the continent, our mission products. And these folks say, how can you support a regime there that is so white colonial? And so these grants are given, and for humanitarian purposes, That means that they buy textbooks and crayons for the kids. They have to provide schooling for the kids out in these areas that they control. Health things, health supplies, pay for nurses to get a minimum amount of training. All that kind of thing that you need to keep a society going while a revolution's going on. And again, if our memory was a little clearer, we'd remember those problems in the revolution, our own revolution. So the World Council gets criticized for those grants by the people who don't agree with those policies, and it's very hard to communicate the nature of the discussion that leads to those controversial decisions in all the places in Germany, Britain, or the U.S. And it's often the reporting that sets up the problem more in worse form, because it tends to take just one side. It does not show all the variety of Christian opinion about it. It does not show the agony of trying to delve into your theology deeply enough to ground it well. What it does is just take the most flagrant sort of controversial things and often report them in an inflammatory way. Like, look at the descriptive terms. Think of yourself as a black African Christian under persecution in South Africa, trying to get free of a system that of all the churches of the world, only the three white Reformed churches in South Africa say this is according to the will of God. All the others say, how can you possibly justify apartheid by scripture or by the Christian faith? And these black Christians down there are living in that situation. So look at each one of these reports you see in the Reader's Digest or CBS or whatever, your local paper, and read it from the attitude of a black African, and you'll see that guerrilla, terrorist, never any other term used. And those are loaded terms for people who stand to lose from terrorist activities like us, or guerrilla fighters that we don't identify with. So that's a very controversial part of the thing. Now, goodness. The fourth one was education renewal in the search for community. That was the one I worked with. It deals with youth work, the educational programs, the church schools that are becoming part of the national systems of schooling in different parts of the world. Deals with theological education around the world and all the attempts to train ministers and to help share resources on that. With Bible teaching, dialogue with people of other faiths and so forth. Christian medical work, which again is a part of the total mission work, scholarship program, family education, etc. And I think that's fairly familiar, so let me just stop and say that that's the basic framework of the whole World Council of Activities. It's about 300 staff people, about 100 of them, 110 of them, are professionals like myself. The rest are support staff, financial services, etc., etc. That's probably more than you wanted to know about the World Council. I apologize for going so long, but you made the mistake, some of you, of looking interested and tempting me to go ahead. But please, what I'd like to do now is get away from that and get at the questions that most bother you about it, your understanding of it. Yes, sir.
Is it right that the Catholic Church and the Mormon Church are not members?
Yes.
Is there any specific reason why they are not?
Well, those are two different questions. The Mormons are not, because most of the Christian churches in our country, where the Mormon faith is a live option, don't quite know whether to include the Mormons in the Christian corral or not.
Right.
Among the free churches that have developed, like the Mormons, there are some that have dimensions of their doctrine that seem to fall outside the fences that previous discussions of what's Christian and what's heresy have defined, way back from the Council of Nicaea on up through the Augsburg Confession and so forth. And my sense is that with the Mormons, we're still in that process of their settling into their doctrine and of the negotiation and confrontation, still searching for clarity as to whether they deserve to be included in the main Christian church.
Does that mean the World Council had not accepted them, or do they want to become members?
They have never applied, as far as I know. Now, they're probably somewhere in all these efforts. There are probably conversations going on. There are probably conversations about overlapping work. But the Mormons still are relatively tight, inclusive ship. Roman Catholics, there has been an up and down with the Roman Catholics. 10 years ago, 20 years ago, right after Vatican II and with Pope John, there was much hope that there could be Roman Catholic involvement. Now, part of the problem is they are so large that for them to simply become a member church would overwhelm it. For them to have their separate national conferences of bishops join as separate churches would violate their sense of unity. Theologically, they claim that they are the only church and that sooner or later everybody's going to come back to Rome. They don't really push that very hard now. The affirmation in Vatican II of separated brethren and sistren is pretty well substantiated, and behind the scenes, the cooperative work has been pretty good. Right now, we're in a backlash from that Vatican II, the whole Catholic Church is. And they are trying to sort out what it means to be so ecumenical. And the latest report in one of these ecumenical reviews of what's called the Joint Working Group, which is the key cooperative agency that works every year in meetings to address that question, what is the relationship? This report is one of the most discouraging of the six assemblies, because right now there's not much involved. The Pope is supposed to go to Geneva just before he was shot and to visit the UNESCO and so forth and pay a visit to the World Council as Pope Paul VI did back in 67 or 68 or something. And he was supposed to make that visit sometime this year, I think. So you might watch the press to see if that happened. But with this Pope and with the present mood of the Catholic Church, there's not much moving ahead at the official level. Now, what Janet Wasonga said is still going on. You know, Catholics and Protestants are less and less feeling separate from each other wherever there's a live mixture. Yes.
I have a question regarding the different denominations that have their own divisions of life and mission and are supporting Zimbabwe or other causes, and maybe all denominations are. What is the responsibility of the World Council of Churches in that area then? Do they report to you?
You mean do the churches?
The different churches who are sponsoring, like sending money to Zimbabwe, or like the American Lutheran Church Women are sponsoring Zimbabwe Exchange Program. What is the responsibility then of the World Council of Churches in that area?
Well, it's let me try to choose some careful words and then explain them. It is not the only channel. It is not the major channel. A lot more money and things go outside the World Council and go through the World Council. It is a very important coordinating part of that whole traffic. And what happens is that the people who represent the ALC in the interchurch aid things, in the different committees of the World Council, know about all the different parts of their church's involvement in Zimbabwe and vice versa. where they go to the meetings and see that there is an advantage in channeling certain parts of it through the World Council structures instead of continuing to go parallel and separate, then they work to see if that can happen back home in their own shop and in the World Council. A lot of it has already been worked out cooperatively so that if there's a sudden emergency and stuff, it'll go. So that they, your representatives have to try to work it out, as ours do from the Presbyterian, what's the best way to keep helping people at home like you or me feel that we are directly involved in that through knowing people, through getting personal reports on what our money does over there and so forth, and somehow having the whole strategy of church aid into Zimbabwe meet the priorities that the Zimbabweans, as best the Christians there can sort it out, say these are the things we most need. So that the World Council puts out a big project book every year that lists hundreds and hundreds of projects from all around the world. And what it tries to do is enable, say, the people in Zimbabwe, the churches in Zimbabwe, the Council of Churches, or whatever group that brings together the different denominations there, let them say that the most important needs we have in Zimbabwe are these, 1, 2, 3, 4. And those may not be the same priorities that your Methodist or your Presbyterian or your Lutheran direct track say. There's a lot of old boys game going on always. That is, if there's a missionary who's got two brothers in the agency in Minneapolis or Atlanta, Georgia, if there's a family of missionaries that's been in Zaire Fire Church for 90 years successively, and they've got kinfolks all over the Southern Presbyterian Church, and you try to say that priority that to get a new wing on your hospital out there in Zaire is not a priority of the Council of Churches in Zaire, then they'll say, well, we still want our wing on the hospital. And they still have access to people who will go with that priority against the cooperative decided priority. There's no neat answer to that. It's always in flux, always in negotiation, always caught between the problem of the necessity for bureaucratic structures to deal with the mass needs and the mass resources and the need for personal contact that's part of the way the motivation and the meaning of it comes on both sides. So there's no simple answer, and in connection with a particular project, your representatives in Minneapolis who deal with that would know how to answer that in detail. They work with it all the time, that kind of problem. Yes.
Does any church who becomes a member of the World Council of Churches have to accept that statement of faith?
Yes. That's the only basis. They have to have a certain number of members. I think it's 10,000 minimum, kind of. In other words, World Council is a council of churches, and that has that doctrinal base, plus a few pragmatic things. It's not just a congregation. Obviously, that wouldn't be easy to handle. But this basis is the basis. So even people ask me occasionally, are the Jewish members of the World Council, the Buddhist members? Well, no, it's a very tight Trinitarian basis, actually. The Quakers, for instance, have some troubles with its tightness. But let me one more story about the Kimbangwe's Church in Zaire. You may know about the Kimbangwe's Church. You may have heard of it. It's got 4 or 5 million members. And it was started about 70, 80 years ago by a prophet there named Simon Kimbangu, who was put in jail, and he preached. It's sort of an Africanized version of missionary preaching. Well, they came to the Central Committee in Utrecht after working with a missionary who was on the staff, former Presbyterian missionary who was on the World Council staff, who tried to help them with the application. They had applied, and then you go through a probationary period while they studied, so they'll know what they're doing, and we'll know what we're doing in the World Council. And it got up to the decision in the central committee. And one theologian got up and said, well, what about the doctrine of baptism? Well, they said, we haven't really worked all that out yet. Said, well, what about ordination? How do you tell who has the right to preach? And they said, well, you know, we still just sort of, whoever feels called, mm-hmm. preaches. And everybody kind of shook their head. You know, all the Europeans and Americans had got at least 20 centuries of protecting poor God against the varieties of heresies. Somebody said, it's just like a New Testament church, isn't it? Well, that kind of settled the argument, and they were voted in. But it's that sort of pressure on the established churches, you see, of all these new churches and stuff.
Yeah. Will you be going to Vancouver now, will you, for the beginning of that, and being in on most of it, or what?
No. I have no real reason to be there. And I went through the one at Nairobi, and I'm going up on the 1st of August for 3 days, primarily to represent the Union Seminary at the alumni luncheon, but to see old friends, and I will just be there a couple of days. I have no official relationship to it.
Did you see some hope for inner communion in the light of the recent Lutheran Episcopal decision for inner communion?
I'm not familiar with the details of that, but they pretty much moved ahead, didn't they, on that statement? If I remember,
but that was very much interested in discussing Archbishop James Crumley of LCA with the Archbishop of the Eastern Orthodox Church, and also Pope Paul John Paul.
Those
seem to be very much interested in how we managed to pull that off. And
those so-called bilateral discussions have helped clarify a whole lot of those points.
Also, it would be before the Lutherans and Presbyterians come in. I used to hear the Lutherans are closer to the Presbyterians than anybody else, but we were communing with the Anglicans, why not the Presbyterians?
Well, we are, actually. Yeah. You'd have no problem at any of our churches, and
well,
the invitation
in an official capacity. Is the consultation on Christian unity, was that a stumbling block?
No, that's another approach that's also moving along. Again, locally, a whole lot of things happen. With a kind of lay people's, I think, deep understanding of a theology that you might call God understands. When Christians get up to the point of saying, you can't share this bread and wine with another person who says, I believe in Jesus Christ, you know, something just says, that is not right. You know, something screwed up.
He's a Christian.
And so that they just do it. And there are all kinds of things happening like that which are working up the way to official status. Now, let me just say my last sentence. Where I end up in all this is realizing in more than I've said, and in more than any of you can know who haven't been in of it, the pain and agony of the struggle to put it together, and the strength of the temptations to retreat back into what's comfortable. It's a stretching experience to be ecumenical, and the World Council is the cockpit of all that fighting. But the glory is the struggle.